Chapter 20 Refuge. Inside the Grand Tempestus, all was quiet. Few people spoke, beyond muffled prayers or the coughing of the injured. The Glimsmen and Dwardin tended their wounded, while keeping wary eyes on the visible entrances. The citizens had gathered in bunches throughout the nave or against the walls. Some moved aside as Balthus led Quicksilver down the nave, away from the main doors. His warriors split up into smaller cohorts composed of sequitors and castigators, towards the 12 entry points. Helios and his celestors sat in a watchful line before the main doorway, their weapons across their knees and corpuscent dancing across their armor. Gellius had set his ballista up on the altar, shaped like a massive 12-pointed star, where he had a clear view of the entirety of the nave and the main entry hall. Kallis Eltain's liberators still held their posts at the doorways. He saw no reason to pull them from that duty. 12 warriors, more or less, would make little difference. They would act as alarms, just in case the wards were breached and the dead managed to get inside. When he said as much, Miska frowned.
They deserve better than that, I think.
Balthus didn't look at her. We all do.
Especially the mortals.
Miska looked around. Her face was set in a frown.
I suspect you used Fosco and Judson to absorb the brunt of the enemy, to gauge their strength. We should have pulled them back from the beginning. I knew that and said nothing. Too many died that need not have.
You disapprove of my strategy?
You are Lord Arcanum.
I am, and I saw fit to preserve my troops for as long as possible. Balthus sighed and looked at her. The mortals had their duty as we have ours. Now we must concentrate on what comes next. He gestured to Fosco, and the Free Guilder trotted over, followed closely by Judson. The Dwardin Thane was pale and moved slowly, but seemed to be on the mend.
Status? Balthus asked, without preamble. Most of my men are walking wounded, Fosco said bluntly.
Bitten? Fosco grimaced.
No, thanks, Sigmar, but we're checking even so. If we find one, we'll deal with it quietly.
He looked as if he wanted to spit, but refrained.
I left the best part of my command out there, Lord Arcanum. The dead were on us too quick. We're used to dealing with single night haunts, or just a handful. Never seen this many in one place. He swallowed. Never wanted to.
Judson nodded grimly.
We weren't prepared. Too many manling promises of impenetrable walls lulled us, and now we're trapped.
Feel free to leave, Fosco said.
You'd like that, wouldn't you?
Judson sneered.
No, you would have to open the doors, Balthus said. That would not be ideal.
We are not trapped, he said after a moment. This place is sturdy. It can be defended, if not easily. A siege might last days or weeks if we're cut off from the rest of the city.
Fosco let the thought hang unfinished.
We should ask Obol about supplies. See what the Azurites have been hoarding in this oversized chapel of theirs.
Balthus turned, scanning the crowd of mortals. Priests in robes of blue and gold wandered through the crowd, speaking softly to those who huddled weeping, or sternly to those whose faith seemed lacking. The one in charge was a portly man, with a cavernous scar disfiguring one side of his round features. It ran across his eye, which gleamed white in its ravaged socket, and up over the crown of his bald head. He wore gold-plated armor over his robes, but cradled a battered, utilitarian-looking mattock in the crook of his arm. He was speaking to an elderly couple as Balthus approached, the others in tow.
Lector Obol,
Balthus said, pitching his voice low. Obol turned, his good eye widening slightly. Balthus knew a little about him from Fosco.
One of several priests, or lectors, as the Church of Sigmar called them, sent by the Grand Theogonist from Azir to oversee the spiritual welfare of the citizens of Glimsforge, both Azirite and otherwise. A former war priest, Obol now spent most of his time seeing to the upkeep of the Grand Tempestus. Obol bowed as low as he was able, given his bulk.
"My lord, you honor me. Honor us with your presence."
Obol glanced at Fosco and smiled.
"Glad to see you survived, you old wastrel."
His smile faded.
"Can't say I expect we'll all be so lucky. If this keeps up, though."
"Supplies," Balthas said. Obol blinked.
"Some stores in case of disaster," he said after a moment. "Not enough for this lot, though. Even depending on whether you eat."
He looked at Balthas, eye narrowed.
"Forgive my impertinence, lord, but do you?"
"We do. But we do not need to, save rarely."
"Shame," Obol said. He patted his belly.
"Sigmar knows best, I suppose, but a good meal sets the world to rights, I've found."
"Often, by the looks of ye,"
Judson grunted. The Dwardin sat heavily on a nearby bench. Obol laughed.
"And have you ever turned down a meal, Thane?"
Judson squinted at him and rubbed his chest as if it pained him.
"What sort of fool does that?"
He turned.
"I remember installing a well, so there's water at least."
Balthus looked down at him.
"You built this place?"
Judson gestured dismissively.
"Why do you think I wanted to be the one to defend it? Took me months to get the capstone set properly. I wasn't going to just sit back and let a bunch of walking corpses infest it."
He stroked his beard.
"We could always use the tunnels, if need be."
Fosco frowned.
"The catacombs would be worse than staying up here. Besides, I'd heard they'd sealed them off."
"Not the catacombs," Judson said. "There are tunnels running throughout the city. We of the Riven clans dug most of them. If we could get down there, we might stand a chance."
"And go where?" Obol said. "The city is under siege. The dead are everywhere. At least here we know they can't get in. Sigmar would not allow it."
Judson felt silent. Balthus looked up at the high dome overhead. It was covered in a heaving shroud of geists and hoarfrost.
"Sigmar might not allow it, but he is not the only god present here today, I fear," he said.
Obol paled and made the sign of the twin-tailed comet.
"Then it is true what they say? Nagash moves against Azir?"
Balthas looked at him. "Who is this they everyone refers to?" He held up a hand.
"Never mind. Yes, I want an accounting of supplies. You will provide it."
Obol bowed awkwardly and hurried away, calling for several of the junior priests to accompany him. Balthas turned to Fosco.
"This place must be fortified. I want the entry halls blocked off, if possible. It won't stop the night haunts, but the dead walkers are a different story."
Fosco frowned.
"We're staying then?"
"For the moment," Balthas said. Fosco nodded and turned to rejoin his men. When he'd gone, Judson laughed harshly.
"Busy work, is it?"
"What do you mean?" Judson tapped the side of his head.
"I'm no fool. This place was never meant to be a fortress, whatever manlings think. And it won't keep the dead out for long, blessings or no. So, you're thinking of something else. Fosco doesn't see it yet, but he will."
He peered towards his own warriors. They had erected their heavy shields into a bulwark and were priming their drake guns. One of them began to sing, softly at first, and then more loudly. Other Dwardin joined in, their deep voices echoing through the nave. Balthas watched, perturbed.
"What are they doing?" "Singing," Judson growled. "D-
Did you think we did not know how?
Balthas hesitated. I knew. I have simply never heard it.
Few have, outside the clan halls. Our songs are not for the ears of the unwrought. Today, we make an exception.
Is it a dirge? Judson looked at him.
Of course not. Why would you think that?
Balthas didn't reply. Judson snorted and heaved himself upright and made as if to stand. Balthas moved to help him, but Judson waved him off.
The day I need help to stand is the day I no longer deserve to do so.
Judson limped towards his warriors, one hand pressed to his chest. In moments, his voice joined theirs, rising in song. Balthas watched them sing for a moment. He glanced up at the windows, where ghostly faces were pressed to the glass, wailing silently. He imagined the night haunts clinging to the outside of the cathedral, and felt faintly nauseated.
They will not get in,
Miska said after a moment. She had stood silent while he conversed with the others, keeping her thoughts to herself. Now he looked at her, wanting her opinion. He felt uncertain, something he was not used to.
Are you sure of that? Aren't you?
Once I might have been. But now, that thing, that creature leading the dead, was Thorm.
I saw it. Felt it.
Balthas sagged back onto the bench Judson had vacated. He wanted to take off his helm, but didn't. It would be a sign of weakness, and he needed to be strong. Strong enough to make right what he had allowed to go wrong.
He killed Linos, his own Lord Celestant, and Balthas.
He almost killed you as well,
Miska said.
Something has happened to him. He has been altered somehow. His soul is tainted. The light of Azir is trapped in a shroud of darkness.
Balthas shook his head.
Only a god could do such a thing.
Nagash,
he nodded.
He has captured the soul of a stormcast before, more than once.
Indeed, for some years we thought it was his driving obsession, but never before has he managed something like this. I am forced to wonder if he has the capability now. Are any of us safe?
Sigmar would not allow it.
We must pray that it is so. Balthas bent forwards.
I saw into his mind. What was left of his mind?
He grimaced.
It was like a nest of maggots making a hollow carcass dance. It is him, but he is just a mask for the thing inside. And I saw its plan.
The 10,000 tombs?
Miska said, anticipating him.
A place of censure. A moment of black time, stretched across roots of stone and left to fester.
Balthas closed his eyes, trying to forget the feeling of being in Thorm's head.
There are 10,000 souls imprisoned below us. Fell souls, warlords and sorcerers, tyrants and failed heroes. More potent than the spirits commonly hurled against us, and left imprisoned here by the will of the Undying King.
Why would he do such a thing?
Miska asked.
I have always wondered. Surely such souls might have been more useful on the battlefield, rather than chained here in the dark?
Unless even Nagash feared they might prove too hard to control,
Balthas said.
That he seeks them now should give us all pause.
He looked at her.
Where is Kallis Eltain? I must speak with her.
She is at her post.
Miska looked down at him.
Are you going to tell me why?
We know where they are going. Why else would Nagash send Pharus Thorm back to Glimsforge, save to open the vaults he once defended? And to get there, they will tear this temple down stone by stone. It is not safe here. We cannot defend this place for long. We will be overwhelmed long before Knossos is able to reinforce us.
the only safety is down.
The catacombs?
We cannot make our stand here. They will overwhelm us sooner or later. So we must withdraw to face them on more optimal ground. There are reinforcements below.
If we cease our prayers, they will rush in.
Then someone must stay.
A death sentence?
She did not sound angry. Balthus nodded.
Yes. Volunteers?
One will be enough.
And you have one in mind?
Balthus was silent. Miska smiled faintly. Go, speak to Eltane. I will tell him. She turned away. Balthus raised his hand, dropped it. Thank you, Mage Sacristan.
It is my duty, Lord Arcanum.
He watched her go, and then let his gaze drift across the interior of the temple. Even now, preoccupied as he was, he couldn't help but calculate the geometries of the place. It was such a small thing, plain and pale next to the glories of Sigmaron, as Glim's Forge paled next to Azirheim. But both were groping towards that glory in their own way. That, in the end, was the difference between gods. When Nagash forced everything into the same shape, his own, Sigmar sought to raise his people up. To serve Sigmar was to forever reach for the stars above. To serve Nagash was to never notice the stars at all. His eyes found the reliquary that rested at the opposite end of the nave from the main doors. It was the largest chamber in the temple, built to house the bones of the faithful, and now 100 or more citizens of Glimsforge crowded within its embrace. Innumerable skulls marked by the symbol of the High Star peered down at the gathered mortals. Longer bones had been laid beneath the skulls, and thousands of phalanges hung from the ceiling. The reliquary radiated a peace utterly at odds with the dead things outside. Here, a soul could find true rest, safe from the machinations of the undying king. A shame that such peace would soon be disrupted. Another necessary sacrifice. It seemed to him as if there were too many of those of late. Perhaps Miska and Tyros were right. He was easily distracted. He had not steeped himself in blood the way others had. He had always thought himself possessed of a higher purpose, not just a warrior, but a seeker of hidden truths. But what was the truth here? The only one he saw was that he had failed, and his failure had compounded itself in ways he had never imagined. There was no telling what Thorm had done, or would do, if he was not released from Nagash's control. He leaned his head against his staff, seeking equilibrium. He stared at the bones, at the ranks and rows of sainted dead lining the reliquary, and wondered where they were now. Lyria was but one underworld among millions. He could feel spirits here, watching. They existed outside the awareness of all but the most sensitive of mortals, and those possessing a spark of the divine. The truly dead, those who had passed beyond even the reach of gods, into spheres unknown and unknowing. Only a rare few in the realms were so lucky as to travel on to that undiscovered country at the moment of their death. Many souls were trapped in the weft and weave of the realms, drawn into the ether that permeated everything. Sometimes they escaped, but other times they simply sat, waiting for one god or another to collect them, or for the winds of magic to cast them back into physical form through rebirth or reincarnation. He knew this as surely as he knew that the war being fought in the realms was not just a battle over physical territory, but a war for souls. The souls of all those who had been or ever would be, even those souls already claimed by another. He closed his eyes, listening to the wails emanating from beyond the walls of the temple. He felt suddenly weary, and his grip tightened about his staff. Corpusant flared softly, dancing in tune to his simmering frustration. He had failed. Twice now he had faced Varus Thorm, and twice he had failed to contain him. Twice he had failed to prevent the repercussions of the rogue soul's rampage. The third time would be the last. He did not know how he knew this, only that it was as certain as the stars above, as constant as the firmament. As this understanding filled him, so too did warmth, driving back the edges of fatigue and bringing with it clarity. He could see the way ahead clearly now. He was on the correct path. The battle could not be won here, but elsewhere it might be possible. Like a hunter, he had to find the proper ground. He could almost feel Sigmar's hand on his shoulder. Magic, sorcery, ether working, whatever you called it, it was all about ritual. About the meeting of craft and circumstance, the right words, the right gesture, at the right time. Too early or too late and the spell would not work. Like a hunter taking aim at his prey. Release the arrow too soon and the prey escaped. The time had not been right before, but it would be. He just had to recognize the moment and let his arrow fly.
"You look tired. I didn't think your sort could get tired."
Balthas turned. Judson stood nearby.
"We can," Balthas said,
"but I am not." "Have you finished singing then?"
Judson grunted and tugged on his beard.
"Yes, for the moment,"
he sniffed.
"We're in the crut, and no two ways about it."
"Yes, but I might have a solution."
"Come with me." Judson grinned. "I knew you were a clever one. The moment I saw you, I said to myself, Grum, there's a clever sort of manling."
Balthas frowned. "Let us hope you are proven correct." He and Judson found Callis standing near the main doors, her gaze fixed. She spun as she registered their presence, her blade springing up. Balthas didn't hesitate.
"Your dutifulness does you credit, Liberator Prime."
She nodded tersely and turned her attentions back to the doors.
"As you say, Lord Arcanum."
Balthas could feel her dislike of him, and he smiled. Eltaine was not practiced in hiding her feelings.
"The 10,000 tombs," he said. "You were one of those who guarded it?"
"I was sent down only recently," she said doubtfully.
"Can you find your way into it?"
"I barely found my way out, let alone back in, unaided. The ruins change shape constantly. Varus did something. He created false walls and streets to nowhere to confuse intruders."
"Varus did nothing. We built those things,"
Judson frowned.
"Granted, he came up with the idea and drew the plans, but it was Dwardin hands that piled those stones, and Dwardin minds that improved on his human cleverness."
He packed so much condescension into the final word that Balthas felt vaguely insulted on the former Lord Castellan's behalf. He looked down at the Dwardin.
"Then you or one of your clansmen can lead us."
Judson laughed harshly and then winced. He clutched at his chest.
"No, manling. That place was built to isolate itself. Things move at random. Walls switch places, floors dip, paths bend back on themselves."
He shook his head.
"We know our business. Varus didn't want anyone getting in there without his permission, so we made sure of it. Only the warriors assigned to protect the tombs know the way in and out."
He frowned and looked at Callis.
"Most of them, anyway."
"And Elia,"
Callis said idly. Both Judson and Balthas looked at her.
"Who?"
Balthas asked.
"The child. The girl. Varus said that she kept managing to get in. And he didn't know how."
She shrugged. "If I hadn't seen it myself,
I wouldn't have believed him.
Balthas shook his head.
A child. She's shrewd.
Balthas frowned. The rudiments of a plan were beginning to form.
Let us hope so.
He looked at Judson. The tunnels below, the ones you mentioned before, with Fosco and Obol, do all of them lead in the same direction?
Judson saw what he was getting at immediately.
No, some lead elsewhere in the city. We can reach our clan halls, even.
He squinted, looking around.
Slow going with these, especially if we have to fight.
You won't have to. The dead aren't interested in slaughter, at least not these. Balthas looked back at the windows above the main doors. Pale, distorted faces screamed in silence there.
They'll follow us. How can you be sure?
Balthas looked down at him. Judson grunted and made a gesture of surrender.
Fine. You know your business.
He tugged on his beard, frowning.
I'll just go make the preparations then, shall I?
He stumped away, still pulling on his beard.
What is going on? What are you planning?
Callis said, deference tossed aside. Balthas studied the doors.
We must leave this place.
I have orders to ensure that nothing gets past these doors.
And you would perish in the doing so, your soul to be claimed by phantasmal jailers.
Balthas gestured dismissively. An inefficient use of resources.
Once we get into the catacombs, you will be needed.
Callis shook her head in confusion.
Go down, but we can't...
We can.
Callis's eyes widened slightly.
Elia, you mean to use her?
You said she managed to find her way below. We need a guide.
Callis frowned.
She's a child. It would not be safe.
Balthas looked at her.
Yes, and there is nowhere safer in this city than with us. He paused. If we do not do this, the dead will surely break open the 10,000 tombs. You will fail in your duty, Liberator Prime. We both will.
She stared at him for a moment, then nodded.
Come, I will take you to her.
They made their way back to the reliquary, where the air stirred with the echoing hush of prayer. Many of the mortals had wrapped themselves in cloaks and blankets, passed out by the priests who moved among them. Some huddled in the corners, staring at nothing. Others spoke quietly among themselves. This ceased as Balthas and Callis appeared. A priestess hurried towards them, but Balthas waved her aside.
Where is the child?
He asked. The priestess hesitated. Balthas realized that specificity was called for. There were many children in the reliquary.
The girl, he said.
The priestess looked around helplessly.
Elia,
Callis called softly.
Heya,
a small voice called out. Callis started towards the back of the reliquary. Balthas followed. They found the child, a girl of perhaps 10 seasons, sitting beside a lanky man sleeping fitfully. A young woman sat near them, and she started at their appearance. Elia whispered to her, and then settled back beside her father. Balthas could smell the fear that permeated him. His mind, slumbering as it was an open book to Balthas's storm sight, and all but impossible to ignore. Scattered memories flashed across his perceptions. The man, Elia's father, lived in a stew of recrimination and terror. Something had broken him in ways too difficult to repair.
Duvac,
Callis said. Balthas looked at her. She pulled off her helmet and hung it from her belt.
His name is Duvac, Duvac Eltos. He is her father, a lamplighter.
He is broken.
One does not preclude the other,
Callis said, looking down at the man. There was something in her gaze that made Balthas look away. He looked at the girl. Elia was dark and scrawny, an urchin, an orphan, for all that she still had a parent. She met his gaze without flinching.
He was struck in that moment by the thought that this was the child he'd seen in Thorm's memories. He did not question it. Something deep in him told him it was true. But what did it mean?
"Do you have a face?" she asked.
"Yes." Balthas tapped his helm and sat down beside her. "This is it."
"Father says that we're fated to die. Will I have a face like that after I die?"
He studied her for a moment, trying to find the words. He suspected that even as a mortal he had not understood children. Fate is another word for certainty, and the only certain thing in any realm is that nothing is certain, not even death.
"The cats don't believe in death. They say it's just a longer sort of dream."
Elia looked up. Balthas followed her gaze. Half a dozen felines lay nonchalantly among the stacked bones, or paced across the floor, tails twitching. One, a brute with a scarred lip, leapt up into the girl's lap. It glared balefully at Balthas for long moments, then turned away with a disdainful twitch of its ears. Elia smiled and scratched the animal.
"I think he's the king," she whispered.
"I wasn't aware that cats had such a thing." She frowned.
"Or maybe he's a marquis."
"Maybe. Despite the folk tales, cats have no king, only a queen. And a queen may have many toms, but a tom only one queen." He scratched the animal under the chin. "Your mother was from Gur, wasn't she? I can see the skeins of amber running through your blood." Elia shrugged with childish inscrutability. Balthas nodded as if she'd replied, and glanced at Callis. She was still watching Duvac sleep. He wondered what was going through her mind. "Did you know that there were once many gods? As many gods as there were people. For every tribe and clan had their god. They were the gods of small things, of rivers and trees and fair winds, death gods as well." Elia looked at him, interested now.
"What happened to them?"
"Oh, their stories had many different endings. Some weren't really gods at all in the end, just monsters. Others became as beasts and lost sight of all that they had been. A few, like the King of Broken Constellations, were killed, while others, like Yarm, old god of the rivers, were defeated and imprisoned by those who came after." Balthas leaned forwards. "But some escaped. They slipped between the cracks in the realms, where even the ruinous powers dare not go. One of those gods was the mother of all cats." Elia frowned.
"Not all cats."
"The first ones, at least. She left her children in every realm. Some were big, some small. Some weren't really cats at all." He glanced at Quicksilver, who lay nearby, beak resting atop his crossed forepaws, and then at Elia. "But all gods leave a little of themselves behind when they go. An echo. A whisper."
"A ghost," Elia said.
Balthas nodded. "If you like. Not all of those echoes take a familiar form. And maybe the new queen of the cats isn't a cat at all. Or maybe it's just a story." He hesitated for a moment, considering why Sigmar had seen fit to place this girl in his path. Not just to guide him, but for some other reason, perhaps. He hoped so. He held out his hand. "I need your aid, Elia. I must get into the catacombs, and swiftly. I do not have the time to do so by the normal routes. Can you help me?" She hesitated.
"Something is coming, isn't it? Not just the Nixos."
"Yes, but we can stop it if you help me." He turned, suddenly aware that every cat in the room was watching him. Armored though he was, he could not help but feel almost like a mouse in that moment. If Elia noticed, she gave no sign. Before she could reply, Duvak screamed. He'd awoken at some point and was now wailing like an animal, trying to scuttle away from Kallus, who reached out as if to comfort him. Balthas caught her wrist. "Leave him," he said, more harshly than he'd intended. Kallus jerked her hand free and turned away, pulling on her helmet as she did so. Duvak had pressed himself against the wall of the reliquary and was muttering a name over and over again. The young woman Balthas had noticed earlier went to him, murmuring gently. Balthas stood. He glanced up again at the cats watching him, watching it all. Elia looked up at him, her expression unreadable.
"Oh, help," she said.
Pharus stretched out his hand towards the doors and felt heat envelop it. The Grand Tempestus was covered in wards, much like those that had protected the city. But only the prayers of those within were keeping them from being overwhelmed by the sheer number of nighthorns clawing at the structure. Given enough time, the Geists could overcome such lesser defenses, especially with Dole urging them to greater frenzy. Throughout the city, Dole's fellow lantern-bearers were doing much the same. The air throbbed with the agonies of Glim's Forge. Malandrek had wounded the city. Now it was up to Pharus to finish the deed. Idly, he wondered what the Knight of Shroud's final fate would be. As far as he knew, Malandrek still fought somewhere in the city, locked in battle with the golden-armored Stormcasts. Perhaps he would be destroyed. Or perhaps Glim's Forge would fall, and he would be named Mortark to join Arcan and the others. Either way, Pharus found that he cared little. Malandrek was a hollow thing, and his petty ambitions paled beside Pharus's sense of purpose. He drew his hand back and studied the smoking gauntlet. The pain was lost in the cold that gripped him. The satisfaction of battle had faded, leaving him empty once more, leaving him craving the lives he could sense within the temple, lives he could not claim, not yet. Screams drew his attention above, where a Geist hurled itself away from the temple, its ragged shape crumbling to fiery splinters of ash as it was overcome by the wards.
"More where that came from, my lord,"
a nearby Dread Warden croaked. The creature still wore the remnants of a road warden's armor over its cadaverous form. In life, it had hunted brigands and outlaws. Now, in death, it acted as their overseer. It raised its staff, surmounted by a ghastly candelabra made from the hand of a hanged man. The candle flames dancing atop the tip of each finger flared, and chain rasps drifted towards the gale of howling spirits that enshrouded the Grand Tempestus.
"Always more," the Dread Warden continued. "No end to them, my lord. No use in them save this. As Nagash wills, so must it be."
"As Nagash wills," Pharus said, turning his back on the creature. He had no interest in speaking to such lowly Geists. Unlike Dole or Roja, their minds were circular tracks, broken only by memories of their mortal lives. Even Felgrip was more companionable for all its silence. The jailer floated at his elbow, its chains shimmering with caged lightning. He could hear the cries of the souls trapped within those links, and wondered what it was like. Were they aware of where they were? Or was their pain that of an animal, senseless and maddening? The thought brought with it only the barest tremor of regret. But pain was the price of truth. Such was the will of Nagash. And as Nagash willed, so must it be. He turned his attentions back to the Grand Tempestus, watching as wave after wave of night haunts attacked the outside of the temple, watching as the temple and those within stubbornly refused to bow to the inevitable. The realm suffered from an excess of will. That was a cosmic truth. Too many souls, too much will, too many lives running counter to the black geometries which guided all things. Nagash sought only to curb this excess, to ensure the continued persistence of the realms. Death was the reaper, and the realms were his fields, overgrown and thick with vermin. Now he plied the scythe to put right all that had gone wrong. Was it right that the grain resisted the bite of the reaper's blade? Why do it? Pharus thought that he once must have known the answer, but could not call it to mind now. He touched his head, feeling the weight of his helm. It constricted him in some manner. As the armor caged him, so too did the helmet cage his thoughts, made him think in orderly lines. He knew that now, but felt no urgency about it. Urgency, worry, these had no place in death's order. Acceptance of inevitability brought peace. All things died, and in death was purpose, more purpose than any possessed in life. Purpose. The thought brought back memories of life, of days spent watching over the dead. He remembered the smell of dust and incense, of dry, brittle bones and damp stone. He remembered the sound of 10,000 dead souls scrabbling at the walls of their tombs. How could he have heard that desperate sound and not felt some touch of pity? How could he not have known the magnitude of the crime he was committing?
The lie of Sigma blinded you to the truth.
But I can see clearly now, he murmured. He knew what must be done and how to do it. I will cast aside the silver chains and shatter the warded stones. I will free the dead.
You will do all of this and more. You will drag down the cruel stars and prove their promises false. Such is the will of Nagash.
And his will must be done. Pharus felt Dol approach. The warmth of Dol's lantern brought its own sort of clarity, different to that imposed by his warplate.
Do you feel it, my lord?
The guardian of souls intoned.
The wards weaken.
Not quickly enough, Pharus said.
But soon.
Dol turned. Pharus felt it as well. The wards were falling, as if the prayers of those within were faltering at last. The hateful light that enshrouded the temple bled away, like frost before the sun. There was a sound, as of the shattering of 1,000 mirrors, and a last flare of cerulean light. It spread outwards, driving his forces back, but only momentarily. In the silence that followed, he drew his sword and echoed its hiss of eagerness. The time had come at last. The scythe would meet the grain, and there would come a great wailing, then only silence, as Nagash commanded. Helios knelt in the center of the nave, head bowed. He ignored the formless shapes darkening the windows and the sounds that echoed through the archways. They would be inside soon, but he felt no fear, no worry, only peace. This was but a single moment in a vast sea of such. Contrary to appearances, the Celestor Prime was not praying. Prayer was for those in search of reassurance. Helios had no need of such comfort. He simply needed to prepare. He concentrated on the tempest sweeping over the city and began to draw down some of its strength into himself. He would need it for a time, just until he had passed this final test. Fear of death was the first test of a Celestor, and the last. It stretched across the entirety of the warrior's span, akin to a shadow cast over life. It could not be bested, only endured. Acknowledging that was part of the test. He had learned that lesson, among others, atop the towers of the Sigmarabulum. 12 weeks of meditation beneath the firmament, with only the stars for company, and rain to quench his thirst. Helios had seen that what once had seemed immense was merely an arrangement of small things, all colliding in the cosmic current. The winds of Azir blew where they would. Uncounted worlds rolled on in the deep. Distant stars were born and then died before their first gleaming had ever reached his eyes, and all without regard for what he or any other endured. Life was an infinitesimal part of that great dance. It meant nothing to the stars or the winds. With that realization had come a sense of tranquility. A warrior, a true warrior, must have courage. Not the courage of one fighting for hearth and home, or the courage of a beast at bay, but a true courage to live life to the fullest, even knowing of its unimportance. The courage to lack certainty and yet persevere. Such was the courage as Celestor learned atop their tower. He had learned that death, while certain, was only a little thing, barely a pause in the music of the spheres. It was not an end, for there was no true ending, merely one more moment among many. The stars shone forever in the black, whether one was there to see them or not, though he was not so stoic as to deny that he would miss watching them. Glass cracked somewhere above him. He could hear the sound of the enemy, like a gale wind tearing at the stones. The protections of Azir were fading, the strength of Shaiish rising. He stood, storm staff in one hand, tempest blade in the other. The weapons felt light, lighter than ever before, as if he might wield them forever and never grew tired, or perhaps as if he had just picked them up for the first time. In the dark above, dead things moaned. Their whispers fell like snow. They recounted the sins of their pasts, attempting to frighten him. But he could not be frightened by mere memories. That was what they were, after all, bad memories and bitter times. Then what was time but a circle of moments? Invariably, the same one came round again if you lived long enough. It was not immortality. There was no such thing as immortality, for it implied a linear constancy. But time did not flow straight. It bunched and wavered, and finally bent back on itself, one moment flowing into the next like a river. The Lord Arcanum thought differently, he knew. For Balthas, the stars were finite. He thought in terms of epochs, of history, one millennium upon the next. Time was a mountain for Balthas. The future rose ever up and away, while the past crumbled below you. Helios wondered if there was something in that. He shook his head. No, perhaps not. Balthas saw the heavens, but not the stars which made them up. Then that was his duty, to see the grand design in all its glory. But for a humble Celestor, the stars were enough. He cocked his head, listening to something clawing at the stones. A shard of glass fell from a window above. He watched it fall, watched the light play off the shards as they scattered across the floor. Miska had not asked him to volunteer. It had not been necessary. When the mage Sacristan had explained the plan, Helios had understood instantly. The final instant, come around again at last. He had lived once and died in a moment like this, though he could not recall it in any detail. And now, having lived, he would die again, painfully perhaps, but gloriously, in a manner befitting a warrior such as himself. Balthas was a generous lord to bestow such a gift. He smiled. There was a poem, at least, somewhere in the meandering. He set the tip of his blade against the stones and began to scratch out the first stanza. He was still writing when the first window fully gave way and the dead poured in. He wondered what they thought as they saw the empty nave and felt the silence. Balthas had led the others below, while the dead slammed themselves uselessly against the outside of the temple. Now, hopefully, they were on their way. But he would buy them a few moments more, just to make sure. Shrieking spirits raced towards him through a storm of glass. He swept his staff out and caught one a solid blow. It convulsed as lightning danced across the links of its chains and was reduced to a charnel mist. He did not stop, but remained in motion, thrusting, slashing, spinning. A few moments well spent. A dozen spirits laid to rest. He stepped back and resumed his composition. A dull boom sounded from the main doors of the temple. Spirits clustered in the broken windows, murmuring and rattling their chains. Helios did not look up as the bravest of their number rushed at him. The poem claimed the entirety of his attentions. His staff lashed out, and a spirit was reduced to tatters. The others retreated. As he scratched words into stone, arcs of celestial energy flickered about him and danced along the lengths of his weapons. Another boom, accompanied this time by a sizzle-scorch sound as the mystic barriers gave way. And at last, the sound of splintering wood. An eerie mist seeped through the archways, slithering about the pillars and coiling in the alcoves. Still, the Celestor Prime did not look up. The poem was close to completion. Heavy boots thudded against the stone, an incongruous sound, utterly at odds with the hissing sand scrape of the night haunts. A smell, like ionized metal mingled with rotting meat, invaded his senses. He paused. "You are a new thing under the sun." The figure stood before him, a black pillar amid the ghostly mist. He was thin, almost spindly, as if all that was not bone and muscle had been sheared away, leaving but a shadow in its place. The armor he wore drank in the light, as did the blade he held balanced across his shoulders. "I am the truth," the dead man intoned. "How portentous! A moment. I have almost completed my poem." "Poem?" the dead man sounded bemused. "It is important to finish what one begins. Don't you agree?" Silence was the only reply. Helios scratched a final word and stepped back. "There. Now we can speak." He planted his blade before him, his hand resting on the pommel as he tapped his shoulder with his staff. "Tell me your name, spirit, so that I might recount it in moments to come." "I am Thorm, and once I was as you are." "Oh, I doubt that. There is no one like me." "Regardless, you are here, and your soul is forfeit." Thorm gestured, and a spectre wreathed in chains and padlocks drifted forwards. "You will be made to see, as I have seen. Falsehood will be burned from you by the radiance of the black sun." "All things are possible." Helios studied the spirit, noting the amethyst light that bled from its padlocks. "But we have not come to that moment yet."
"It is inevitable."
Thorm stepped closer, his black eyes empty of anything save purpose. Helios nodded.
"And yet, here I stand." "Not for long."
Thorm thrust his blade out, and the night horn swept forwards in a howling typhoon. Helios sprang to meet them, moving swiftly. With every gesture, lightning arced out to ripsaw through the legion of spirits. It was rare that Helios could fight to the fullest, for the energies within him were as dangerous to his fellow stormcasts as they were to the enemy. But here, now, in this moment, he was free to do so. Chains struck the floor or tore divots from the pillars as the fight moved through the temple. Helios allowed the night horns to drive him where they would, for he had no strategy beyond holding their attentions. He swept staff and blade out, catching unwary spirits in chains of his own, ones made from lightning. Still they pursued him, flooding through the temple in a wave of tattered shadows. Distorted faces grimaced and yowled as clammy hands fumbled at him, or rusty chains drew sparks from his warplate. For every one he destroyed, two more took its place. Spiked clubs and ruined swords bit at him as he spun and twisted, staying out of reach. He could feel their madness clawing at him, a tangible chill that made his limbs heavy and his head reel. A miasmatic frost clung to the plates of his armor, but the lightning within him carried him on, if not so fast or so sure. Slowed, he found himself being driven back towards a semicircle of drifting shapes. He heard the thump of rawhide drums and glimpsed the leer of bestial skulls within ragged cowls. The night haunts, wielding long black glaives, began to close in on him as their lesser kin continued to harry and hamper him. They had been wearing him down, inevitable, as their master had said. The drifting specters drew near, and he was forced to turn and parry a blow that would have split his heart. His tempest blade swept out, and a ragged cloak folded over as the geist was torn apart. More blades thrust towards him, and he was forced to retreat. Everywhere he looked, the dead looked back. He spun and lashed out, his storm staff passing through several grisly visages with little resistance. Lightning sparked out, dancing through their ranks. He turned, spinning his staff. The tempest built within him. But he would not release it for just any spirit. Not when he had gone to the trouble of weaving a trap of his own. They had harried him, and he had allowed it, knowing that they would drive him ever closer to... Ah, and there it was. The jailer spirit, in its screaming chains, descended on him as he fought, seemingly oblivious to its approach. Miska had told him all about the creature, about what Balthas had seen. The souls of his brothers were caught up in its chains, condemned to an unknown fate. The mage Sacristan hadn't known if destroying the creature would be enough to free them, but Helios saw no harm in trying. He waited until it was within reach, then turned, letting his staff slide through his hand, so that the tip slammed into the bestial helmet. The creature squalled and swung its chains at him. He ducked aside and twisted his staff, catching the links. A flip of his wrist further tangled them about the length of the staff, and he could feel the soul within calling out for release. Before the spirit could rip itself free, he lunged, striking it in the head again. As he did so, he let the tempest loose. Chains of crackling energy lashed out from him, ensnaring the jailer's spirit. Some of it raced along the creature's own chains, setting the rusty links alight with cobalt flame. The light swelled about him, washing away the shadows and momentarily driving back the dead. Helios felt his staff grow hot as he struck again and again until it punched through the creature and struck the floor. The jailer spirit gave an ear-splitting screech as celestial lightning rip-soared through it. Helios released his storm staff an instant before it splintered, consumed by the energies racing through it. The explosion hurled him backwards into a pillar. The stone cracked, and he tumbled to the floor. As his staff broke apart, so too did the jailer spirit, which burned with a purifying radiance. Its chains melted into molten slag. Helios heard the imprisoned souls sing out as they were freed, and lightning speared upwards from the burning links, shattering the great dome above and casting a rain of glass down onto the spirits below. As the reverberations faded, Helios rose to his feet, bits of glass sliding from him. He tried to take in a breath, and his ribs creaked painfully. His neck and shoulders ached where he'd struck the pillar. His armor was scorched and dented by the fury of the tempest he'd unleashed. Besides the pain, he felt wrung out, empty, but satisfied. A final bit of good before the end. Not enough. Never enough, but some.
"You will pay for that," Thorm said in the silence that followed.
He emerged slowly through the gathering ranks of the dead, sword tip carving black trails in the stones at his feet.
Your soul will scream in agony before you are remade in the image of he whom you defy.
To speak and act are one and the same. Nothing will prevent me from doing as I have said.
Helios swept his tempest blade up and gripped the hilt with both hands.
Can the same be said of you? He drew the blade back and readied himself. Come, let us see.
Thorm roared, mouth distending abnormally, and charged. Helios stepped forwards. When the moment came around at last, he was ready.